Welcome to American Dream. I'm your host, Tina Richards. Hate crimes in America, according to a recently released FBI report, states that there's been an 8% increase. Has there been an increase? Is there a truth to this? Or is that just another manipulation of numbers? In order to talk about this, we have with us Ibrahim Hooper, yes, with the National Communication Director of CARE,
yes,
and Professor Eric Sterling, Professor of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation at the George Washington University.
Well, I teach at George Washington University. The Criminal Justice Policy Foundation is not affiliated with George Washington University.
Two separate. Okay. And what I'd like to start with is the hate crime reporting. One of the things is the hate crime reporting is uneven. We started off with a report with over 1,600 hate crimes reported in Los Angeles or California, and Mississippi with zero. What do you think of that?
The statute that provides for the collection of this data does not make it mandatory upon the states to report. It's voluntary reporting. And therefore, some states say either it's too difficult or it's too expensive for us to gather this data, or we can't gather the data in a way that we think is sufficiently reliable, and therefore we're not going to report it.
Well, is there something about the fact that the lowest numbers of hate crimes reported or not reported is throughout the South? Yet traditionally those have been where the highest number of hate crimes have come from, including the fact that in these numbers, the Gen 6 with the nooses hanging and everything else, none of that was recorded on these as hate crimes.
I think there are a couple things you can say. First of all, states like Mississippi and Louisiana are two of the poorest states. Their public services, not only in law enforcement, but in education and health care, are also very, very starved for cash. They might
So are you saying that because they don't have funds that they don't report them? It has nothing to do with the historic
that I am suggesting that that is, in fact, a legitimate reason for them to say we're not going to do it. It is easy for those of us who live up north or in the east to point a finger and say, well, Mississippi, Louisiana, these are places that are notorious for their hate crimes. I would suggest that there is as much racism and religious hatred that gets expressed in New York or New Jersey or Maryland as there might be in Mississippi.
Have you spent a lot of time down in the South?
No, I have not.
Okay.
And
would you like to comment?
In our reporting, we often see that we'll get the most reports, whether it's hate crimes or bias incidents or discrimination, based on population. So it's not surprising to me that you'll get far more reporting from California and New York and Texas than you would from a state with a much lower population. So that's something that's fairly consistent. What we've seen over the years, and particularly since 9/11, is a fairly steady increase in reporting not only of hate crimes but of other bias incidents. Because many things that are reported to us don't rise to the level of a, quote, hate crime. If somebody's fired from their job for wearing a headscarf or wanting to go pray Friday prayers or something of this nature, that's not going to get reported as a hate crime.
It becomes a civil matter rather than a legal or criminal matter.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's why when we issue our annual report, we're the only ones who do an annual report of the status of American Muslim civil rights. We don't call it a hate crimes report because hate crimes are actually usually a minority of the incidents. But you have hundreds and hundreds of other incidents of bias resulting, we believe, at least in part from the rise in anti-Muslim rhetoric in our society in the post-9/11 era.
And we'd like to go ahead. You said that there is a very small amount that are reported anyway.
Yes.
It would compare,
I mean,
like,
well, there,
to the numbers.
There are, you know, to put, you know, there's something like 8,000 reported hate crimes in, according to this data. There are, you know, 14 million reported crimes that the states report to the FBI in the same period of time. That's an enormous number compared to 8,000. So that it is, it's, the other thing then to recognize is as such a small, being a number that is relatively small, very minor fluctuations in the reporting from a single jurisdiction can have a lot of impact on whether or not that number goes up or down. If somebody says this number is up some percent, 8% compared to the year earlier, That percentage increase is of really no statistical significance, because you're not talking about a research effort that is rigorous. It's not rigorous. It's voluntary. And so from year to year,
it's often very subjective too. I'll give you an example. We had vandalism of a mosque, I believe it was in Indiana, and we had a report from the community that it was bias related, and we were contacting the police, and they said, nah, it's just vandalism, nothing to it. And we had to remind them, we had to go back to them and said, no, these were swastikas, Nazi swastikas that were put on there when the police report said scratches. But when you looked at the scratches, they were Nazi swastikas. So often you have to push a little bit to make sure that the bias aspect of an incident is reported. Quite frankly,
that might have something to do with looking at the South and the lack of reporting there in the South.
You know, I've done these cases for a lot of years, and unfortunately, usually what I put it down to is if it's a biased crime, there's more paperwork, there's more hassle, there's more everything for the reporting agency. So sometimes I think even the unconscious bias on their part is, oh, it's just kids vandalizing the mosque, or, you know, they didn't have a bias motive. Because if they have to take it to that next step, you know, federal authorities can be involved at that point. So there's a natural reluctance to take it that extra step. That's why we always go on the record when there's an incident, particularly a house of worship, something like that. We ask the authorities to keep an eye out for a bias aspect. And once they're on, you're on the record doing that, it's a little harder to avoid the situation when it's right in front of them.
Ibrahim, that's a very important point, because not only are police agencies guilty of that kind of minimizing in hate crime area, they're guilty of this kind of minimizing in other areas. In many jurisdictions, Philadelphia, for example, had a major scandal where their crime data, all of their crime data was not reported to the FBI because the police commissioner said the officers are not recording it properly. You know, burglaries being marked down as property crimes so that they would not be reported in the index class one crimes. So that police manipulation of crime data is one of the great problems
police,
that we have
political.
In this whole field.
Mayors are not going to want their jobs listed as
number one hate crime.
It may not be intentional, but there are pressures. Both, watch commanders, shift commanders, precinct commanders are on pressure to reduce the crime rate under their command. The chief of police is under pressure, and the mayor is under pressure. So that all of this can sort of work both overtly and covertly to create inaccuracies, and these inaccuracies are going to be magnified when we're talking about this is a tiny number of cases.
But you just got through explaining how most of the systemic problems with it, lack of finances, maybe even a bias not to report it because of the extra paperwork that's involved in it. Is that an excuse or not to maybe do something more about it?
No, that's
I mean,
not
so that
I'm
we have an
accurate,
I mean, maybe
no,
that's why it's such a small number reported. Maybe that's where the problem is.
Well, that may be. It is, we can sit here and say, okay, we are advocates for more intense reporting or more effective reporting of hate crimes. We can do that. But we can't do that because we've looked at this report, said this report is a statistically useful, valid, and dependable picture of the situation, because I don't think it's that.
I think it can be reasonably used to show trends. You might not be able to compare numbers specifically year to year and category to category, but I think it's good to show trends in the direction we're going. For, as I mentioned, our own reporting, our annual report, has shown an increase every year since 1995 when we first started doing it in the aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombing, when Muslims were first blamed for those 3 days, and there were a bunch of incidents. Every year, the reporting has gone up. And you could say, too, has it gone up, in part at least, because we're more efficient at collecting the data now.
And maybe California, New England, places like that are
exactly
more efficient.
So there are different factors that go into this. But I should say, particularly at the federal level, when we do bring a hate crime to the attention of federal authorities, they react appropriately, they react quickly, and they do a very professional job. So they have to be congratulated at that level. Sometimes you have to push the local authorities a little bit, but once it gets, it's a clear evidence of a bias incident, federal authorities are usually right on top of it.
I think you've described a trend that this is a useful indicator of. And it's important then to talk about it in that sense and not to look and say, well, it's 8%, as though that 8% is something that is mean, that is accurate. It's a trend. And this is true of many kinds of statistical indicators that we have about things that are going on in our society, whether or not drug use is going up or not, or teenage pregnancy or divorce or so on. All of these things are, you know, campaigners love data, you know, and statisticians and social scientists try to be, you sort of always interject a note of caution into how campaigners use data. And it is
so important. Is this necessarily a rise in trend that this is measuring or not?
I would be confident that there has been an increase in attacks upon individual Muslims wearing religious clothing, upon Muslim institutions.
Or people perceived to be Muslim. And we have Sikh attacks.
And people misperceived as Muslims who are not.
We've had Hispanics taken off airplanes when somebody got nervous because they thought they looked Middle Eastern. And the post-9/11 period, we had Sikh men wearing turbans killed. I believe it was down in Texas. One man was shot and killed. I think another was shot and wounded in Arizona because, you know, bigots aren't brain surgeons. They see a turban and they think Osama bin Laden. And, you know, they pull out the six-shooter. So even the perception of being Middle Eastern or Muslim can have an impact on these kinds of things.
So I think a question that is worth asking then is, when we see this kind of trend, how should the society respond? How should civil society respond? How should law enforcement institutions, how should civil rights protecting agencies respond? And that those are the, I think, and what, you know, how should houses of worship that are not Muslim respond? How should Christians and Jews and Buddhists and other faiths respond to the presence of discrimination in the society when they see it against people of faith?
Well, we had some experts that we asked to comment on this. We'd like to hear from them.
Unfortunately, I do think, although I'm not sure about the statistics as for hate crimes, but I wouldn't be surprised by statistics showing that they have increased, because I think, unfortunately, that there is sort of public opinion, particularly in my area of focus, which is immigration, that has become a political issue, and it has been the politicians have used it to cast a lot of negative stereotypes about immigrants that have left them open to different crimes, to being sort of a reviled group by society, and I think being blamed for a lot of things that they aren't necessarily responsible for. And I think that has sort of let the public feel like that they can take certain things out, you know, they can blame certain things on the economy, crime levels, things like that, on immigrants. Which leaves them vulnerable to crime and other issues.
The latest hate crime statistics that have come out of the FBI and the Justice Department, they're very disturbing, obviously. It's part of a larger trend that we've been seeing since September 11, 2001. And a lot of these figures wax and wane, but the general trend has been quite negative. I think it reflects continued increase in a culture of negativity, a culture of fear and anxiety and animosity particularly towards Islam and American Muslims, that is not universal or even a majority view in the United States, but it's the voice of a loud minority, and it does have an effect on hate crimes, discrimination, other forms of discrimination, like housing discrimination, employment discrimination, et cetera.
There have been a lot of incidents against blacks in the crime, and I think part of that is just an overall reflection of when things are bad in the economy or when there's other issues like the war in Iraq, for example, that has people frustrated and gives them sort of a negative outlook, sort of a natural instinct is to look to someone to blame, look to someone to target, and I think that's what we're seeing.
Now, you have mentioned about 9/11 and the rise, and the immigration attorney that was Elizabeth Kohler had indicated that with the war in Iraq, with frustrations heightening, that this would have a lot to do with possibly some of this frustration and that there is a rise.
Our polling shows that between one-fifth and one-fourth of Americans hold actively hostile attitudes towards Islam and Muslims. And
what's the percentage?
Between one-fifth and one-fourth.
So up to 25%.
Yeah. That's a minority, but that's a significant minority. That's millions and millions of people. And that our polling has been confirmed by the Washington Post.
Almost about what elects a president these days.
Yeah, and so it's getting a bit challenging when you've got that many people out there that are actively hostile. You're going to have a minority of that minority willing to carry out acts of violence or discrimination against Muslims. So, and what we're seeing, I believe, is that the rise in the level of anti-Muslim rhetoric in our society is enabling these kinds of attitudes and is promoting these kinds of actions. It used to be, prior to 9/11, that if you attack the faith of Islam itself as evil and had to be destroyed and deport Muslims and all that, you know, you would be on the fringe of the fringe, and you would just be disregarded.
Yeah,
commentary it's moving to the mainstream, and that's an unfortunate phenomenon. We're seeing more and more letters to the editor, Islam is evil, Muslims have to be kicked out and deported and all this kind of thing. So
and
you never
saw... calls from my friend in St. Paul, Minneapolis, that talk about that their neighbors have were raided by the FBI, and everybody's disappeared.
Well, but then we have the first Muslim congressman from Minnesota. Keith Ellison. So there's
positive. Well, I think part of that was in response to the
and fear. He was put in office in a large part, but with the help of the Somali Muslim community in Minnesota.
Right. And now also you have the Los Angeles. Did you hear about this, where they are looking at targeting certain areas that are of Muslim faith?
The police department proposed
mapping.
That was withdrawn. They realized that that was absurd. And I think that this goes to the kinds of things that we need to think differently about in American society.
Do you think that they realized it was absurd, or was there so much protest and opposition? I mean, there was a lot of not only Muslim Americans that were opposing it, but people from the civil rights era and many other places were of the minorities were saying, no, you can't do this.
It was not merely the protests. The protests were well-founded. I think that Bill Bratton, the chief of police in Los Angeles, one of the most sophisticated chiefs of police in the United States, I think he understood very quickly this was a very ill-considered plan, that it had not been worked out. I don't think that it was... I don't think that those who came up with it, only under protest are we changing this. I think that many people got very quickly the fallacious nature and the unwarranted invasion of privacy and the improper stereotyping that was inherent in the conceptualizing of that plan. I was just going to say that in thinking about what can American society do about the problem of hate crime, that there are different sectors have different responsibilities. I think that our public schools need very much to make sure that the curricula include respectful intercultural materials.
Multiculturalism used to be very broadly taught.
And now it's being fought in the schools. We're having parents, again, a minority of parents, but a vocal minority, going and saying, we don't want Islam in our social studies or world religion texts. We only want critical entries on Islam in these texts because we don't think Islam is a good religion.
Right.
So you're seeing more of that.
So here exactly then is the challenge for people of good faith in their communities to go to the Board of Education and the superintendent of schools and say, with all due respect to the fears that my neighbors have, it is important to me that my child be properly exposed to the world as it is and to the American people. I want an accurate understanding. You know, we have 6 or 8 million Americans who are Muslims. I want my son, my daughter, to know about their faith and who they are in the community, because that's part of being in America. I mean, in my family,
the Arabs, though. It is
of
also,
course.
I mean, we're
talking narrowly about that in this context. But of course, these questions also go to the question.
These go to the
questions of sexual identity, and they go to all the various racial and ethnic kinds of things. And these are important because in American history, there is a long tragic history of prejudice and violence against Irish, violence against the Germans, violence against the Catholics, violence against the Italians, violence against the Jews, violence against the Indians. I mean,
Japanese during World War II.
There is no end to the list of those who have been the victims of this kind of prejudice in our history. And it is important then, in one sense, to sort of recognize we're only at a moment in our long history. And the current irrational fears, the current exaggerated fears, are around Muslims because of the perception that the attacks or certain kinds of rhetoric are somehow speak for, a billion people, and they don't. But it's very hard for people who are afraid and not well educated, who don't have, where we as a society have fallen down is our churches are not making efforts to reach out to say that, our co-worshippers in other faiths, we want to know them, we want to bring them to our church to share with us so that we know what their faith is.
To foster understanding. And we're getting ready to go to break, and I'd like to, before we go to break, for you to comment on some of these ideas of where this is at.
Yeah, well, it's interesting we brought up the mapping issue, because now there's another controversy with the Department of Homeland Security is training. There's a pilot program to train firefighters to look for suspicious activity when they're fighting fires in people's homes. And we're objecting to that, because basically what you're setting up is you're having people who may bring their prejudices into a situation, in a warrantless situation where they can go into a home without a warrant, without any suspicion of criminal activity, and they can say, oh, there's a Quran here, that's suspicious, I better report them. There's a prayer rug here, there's people in headscarves here. So there's all kinds of complications, and this is a program that's being implemented by the Department of Homeland Security, and we're issuing particularly out of the Fire Department of New York, because we believe it will alienate the firefighters from those they're seeking to help. We had a situation in New York.
It's part of what their job is to
exactly.
Help
we had a whole family die, and there's a thought that in part because they were reluctant to report the fire because they were undocumented or they had some visa problems.
Hence the sanctuary city.
Exactly.
We're going to go ahead and go to breaks, and we will return soon and talk about this after this brief break. Welcome back to American Dream. I'm your host, Tina Richards. Tonight we're talking about the study of the FBI that reports that there was an 8% rise in hate crimes and whether that is an actual number that's something to be relied on or not. To discuss this, we have Ibrahim Hooper with the National Communication Director of CARE and Professor Eric Sterling, President of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation and also a professor at the Sociology Department at George Washington University.
Yes, thank you.
And we were, just before we went to break, we were talking about the fear of reporting a crime and the couple or the family that was burned. And part of, I think, what Sanctuary Cities, we've done shows on that before, about the fear of reporting.
Well, the phenomenon we've seen over the years is that very often the victim of a bias-related incident will call us before they'll call the authorities because they're just not always comfortable contacting the FBI or contacting the police.
Why do you think that is?
Well, obviously, they're more comfortable with a Muslim advocacy organization that's known for defending civil rights.
Do you think that there's this distrust now that has been
in that anybody
actions?
Likes calling up the FBI, quite frankly. Whatever faith they are, they're probably just there's a little reluctance there. And particularly in the post-9/11 era, for a Muslim to call up the FBI or call up local police. There's a bit of a barrier there. So we often get the calls that they don't, and we pass on the information to the relevant authorities.
And this is a problem that exists with the immigrant community at large, and there are, you know, of something on the order of 15 million people in the United States who are not here with proper documents. A woman that I know was recently robbed at gunpoint. Her purse was taken, $200 in cash were taken. She did not call the police because she fears that she would then be deported.
Well, and that's something that we've discussed, is many crimes not being reported. We did go out and ask some opinions on the street and see what they had to say.
People that commit these hate crimes are a small group of people, and sometimes it just depends on the situation. There are hate crimes against gay people, or hate crimes against black and other minorities and Muslims. I don't think it's specific to Muslims or blacks. It's just, it's this whole thing. There's a whole subculture of hate that's being developed out there that's growing, and it's not just the U.S., it's worldwide, and really, from my perspective, in the U.S., what we can do is try to develop programs that help people to appreciate each other and to understand each other's culture.
I'm probably not the best person to ask, since I'm not part of a group that maybe would have the best view of, would know whether or not those hate crimes are increasing or not, since I guess I'm not part of a demographic that would be persecuted by that type of behavior. I wouldn't be surprised, though, considering the amount of hysteria and the way most politicians have used 9/11 repeatedly to scare people about their own security over and over in the past 5 years, and it seems to never go away, it seems to always be there. Then I wouldn't be surprised that people who are xenophobic to begin with and are inclined to want to persecute someone would feel that they are somehow patriotic or justified in doing so, maybe more so than they would have been before the year 2001.
We've always had hate crimes. I think now we're just hearing more about it. It's becoming more public than I think we've always had it. But I just think now it's just becoming more public, more publicized because of the society that we're living in now. You know what I mean? It's just so much going on that people are becoming more aware that there are hate crimes out there. I think we've always had it.
Well, what do you think? That the hate crimes have always been there?
Yeah, I think hate crimes have always been there.
It's just now being reported.
Well, it's being reported, but it's shifting. The targets are shifting, too. At one point, it was focusing on African Americans or focusing on this group or even communists or anarchists or whatever it was, the Irish at one point, Catholics, whatever.
The professor had indicated that this is just one more slice.
There's always seems to be one group or several groups of people that are the current targets of these kinds of attitudes, and it shifts from time
to
time.
Why do you think that is?
Well, unfortunately, I think, again, a minority of any population is going to have hostile attitudes towards minorities. And if they're enabled, if they're encouraged, which is one point I wanted to bring up, we need to see politicians, religious leaders, and other opinion leaders in the society speaking out more forcefully about these kinds of things. Every time there's an attack on a mosque or something of this nature, we ask the state, local, and federal officials to speak out against it, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to get that kind of response.
I think that, you know, Ibrahim makes a very important point here, which is the importance of confronting this kind of conduct. Because it applies to the total quality of the society. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about anti-Muslim incidents identified in this FBI report. In absolute terms, there were seven times more hate crime incidents against homosexuals in 2006. There were five times more hate crimes against Jews. There were 16 times more hate crimes against blacks.
And, you know, the anti-Muslim bloggers, and there's hundreds of them out there, they point up the fact, oh, well, there were more hate crimes against members of the Jewish community than members of the Muslim community. Well, we're not in a contest to
right.
see to
right.
see who can get which more one? Hate crimes against them. And any hate crime is wrong. Right.
And you were talking earlier about how to some of the solutions for this. And one thing is that hate crimes are usually categorized with higher penalty rates. And
well,
you said earlier that it diminishes the actual crime.
There are sentencing enhancements that exist in various states, and proposals to make the punishment of a crime, if hate was a motivating factor, a sentencing enhancement. And my concern with that is that I don't think that that is a useful way of going to the root causes. I don't think that people will stop hating because they're punished more.
So you oppose this?
I oppose it. I oppose it also on basic sort of justice grounds, which is that the nature of how one is victimized, whether or not one's property is victimized because of simple vandalism, you leave the victim saying, well, is my victimization less because I'm not the recipient of a hate crime, or maybe I suspect it, but I couldn't prove it? It gets into a different, it changes the character of it, I think, in a way, from a justice perspective, that I don't think ultimately helps.
But I would disagree on that. I think it does help prevent these kinds of incidents. I'll give you an example. There was a case in Maine where a man rolled a pig's head into a mosque during prayer. Now, if there isn't any kind of hate crime bias legislation, what's he going to be charged with? Littering? You know? So you obviously his intent was to intimidate and to harass.
Yes.
So you have
yes.
to have some component
yes.
legal action that you can take against this kind of person.
Sure. And I'm not talking about that. I agree that acts that are designed to intimidate, humiliate, create fear, acts that are disruptive and threatening.
Or a man that is beaten simply because of the color of his skin or his religion.
You're saying it
should just be a regular assault and battery, and even though it's explicitly
been
because of that.
Unless he was perceived
exactly.
to be
that
category.
I guess the reason that I would argue that is that it is, I think, two things. In the case of an assault, we're not questioning that an assault is an offense, and a very serious offense. If someone's beaten badly, aggravated assault, you know, carries long sentences in every jurisdiction. So then the question becomes, do we now add an additional penalty because we think we're able to prove, or we suspect and are able to prove, not necessarily because the sentencing, I'm getting technical. Sentencing enhancements don't require proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the way the underlying offense does. So we get into different kinds of standards of proof.
But I should tell you, in experience, what we find is, while they're kicking the person, they're going, you dirty effing Arab Muslim terrorist. So it's not like it's a subtle kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
When these kinds of hate crimes occur, they want to broadcast why they're doing it in general.
Mm-hmm.
So. You, it's not you're reading their mind, you're hearing their words.
Or the recent uses of the nooses.
Those are specific. I want to draw a distinction between the criminal act and the enhancement of a penalty, because we may be able to characterize it as a hate crime. And my concern becomes questions of proof. And these are much more sort of inside the justice system objections that I'm raising. I'm not trying to obviously defend these acts, and I'm not trying to say that they don't deserve to be punished. But I am concerned about the potential imbalance that crime victims feel when they say, why is the fact I've been beaten up, my arm is broken, I'm in a cast, but it's not treated as seriously because it was not done on the basis of my, I was just beaten up for money.
There's an additional component. There's the beating and the reason for the beating. You know, so there is something extra there. It's not just one kind of thing. It's two kinds of things.
And I think that judges ought to be able, within the range of sentencing that they're allowed, to do that. I'm concerned about what ends up being separate, specific kinds of enhancements that sometimes, depending on sentencing systems, may be mandatory or, you know, actually create.
So you think it should just arbitrarily be left up to the judges to whether to apply
judges,
it or not?
Judges historically and appropriately have a range of deciding what the punishment ought to be for an offense. They're not clerks who simply say.
Well, no, we've had mandatory guidelines, mandatory sentencing. I mean, these are all things that are part of the legislative process.
That's going away, too.
Well, the federal sentencing guidelines have been made advisory, but the guidelines have not gone away. The guidelines exist, and there are a range of criteria that judges are supposed to comply with in determining what a just sentence is. And this would be one of the kinds of criteria that a judge would consider, is whether or not there were hate-filled motivations and degrading kinds of things done toward the victim of the crime. That would be appropriate part of what a judge should do, it seems to me, in imposing a sentence. My concern are specialized categories of sentencing enhancements. I'm not talking about making sure that acts of intimidation, such, you know, the example of, you know, rolling a pig's head into a mosque, you know, where it is hard to define that. I mean, that's, you know, is that vandalism? It's not burglary. It's not
littering,
maybe it's trespass. It's not littering. It's clearly, you know, an act that's designed to humiliate and degrade and to intimidate. You know, now that is a kind of offense that I think is an appropriate one to define and to punish for that kind of conduct. And
if hate is separate and not an actual criminal offense, then it should have time. But if it's not an actual, if it is a criminal offense, don't apply it.
And realize this may sound like a distinction that sounds like a terribly terrible lawyer quibble. I am a lawyer, but it would be, for example, if the crime were alleged to be littering, and the judge then was able
aggravated littering.
The judge was then able to say, "Well, we're going to have a classification, you know, let's say of, in other words, should here would be a perhaps a closer question, where the crime of spraying graffiti on the highway, where you're tagging the name of your gang, is one thing versus spraying on the wall of the mosque or the temple or you know, or the church, an epithet or something." Now, there it's not a gang tag. There the motivation is different. And should the crime be defined differently than graffiti for purposes of sort of gang display?
Or a cross in your yard versus burning a cross in the yard of an African-American family,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yes.
Are you saying that there shouldn't be a difference between that?
As we're talking about it, I think I'm changing my mind at this point.
We've convinced you.
Yeah, well, I mean, but I think, you know, I mean, in other words, I approached it from a certain kind of perspective, and this has been a very useful dialogue for me to sort of think through what are the kinds of examples where justice would require that the intimidating behavior be especially identified and appropriately punished. And in the absence of a law to identify that, that would constitute an injustice.
Yeah. One problem is that each state has different laws, different guidelines. There's no one set, you know, enhancement for this kind of thing nationwide on the local level. So maybe these kinds of laws need to be unified in some way.
And I was partly thinking about what happened down in Jenna, Louisiana, mm-hmm. where the same judge that would have dismissed the hanging of nooses, when the African American students retaliated, they were charged with attempted murder with a juvenile schoolyard fight, which was, at this point, have now been reduced, and they're backtracking a lot on this. But this was a judge's decision to prosecute on one level.
And judges have so much discretion, as I'm sure.
And that was, without those enhancements or guidelines, if they're just guidelines, when you encounter a judge that seems to be biased.
As a general proposition, the public needs to pay closer attention to what goes on in the nation's courthouses. I think that they very frequently would be flabbergasted at the kinds of things that take place. I think that the public in general would find, if they saw what was going on, they would be upset that the guilty are getting off, the innocent are being punished, that many participants seem to be rather indifferent to the actual outcome on whether or not they're just.
Yeah, I'd like to go ahead when we start talking about how to combat this. And it's, professor has covered a couple of ideas. Would you like to present
from the Muslim perspective, you know, as a Muslim advocacy group, we try and promote a more positive image of Islam and the Muslim community. We've done a number of different things. We've had anti-terror public service announcements. We've had
This Islamo-fascist week that David Horowitz launched.
Well, we helped the Muslim Student Association do educational efforts at campuses around the country in response to this. But this week was just designed to vilify Islam and Muslims, and, you know, that's their agenda. The more people that they can get who hate Islam and Muslims, the better for them for some bizarre reason. So it was like a recruiting drive for them. But we try and do positive things. When there was an allegation of desecration of the Quran at Guantanamo Bay, we launched a campaign, Explore the Quran. We gave away thousands and tens of thousands of free Qurans to people of all faiths around the country. When you had the Danish cartoons about the Prophet, peace be upon him, we did an educational campaign, Explore the Life of the Prophet Muhammad. We gave away free books and DVDs about the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So we try and always do proactive educational campaigns. We have a campaign right now that we're asking people to sponsor a guide on Islam that we want to distribute to 40,000 media gatekeepers in the United States. So that we have these educational campaigns, and we just need the community support to carry them out.
And it goes back to the multiculturalism that our society, I think before 9/11, used to be very much a proponent of.
The only thing that I would say amen to that is that the Christian denominations, Jewish organizations, should be your partners. They should recognize and embrace that kind of educational effort.
Well, it's interesting you say it. We just had a news conference in San Francisco outside a radio station of the host, Michael Savage, who went on a tirade against Islam and Muslims. Islam is evil. The Quran is a book of hate, all that kind of thing. And who was there? You had Jewish leaders there. You had Christian leaders. You had Muslim leaders there. So the majority of people need to get together and challenge these kinds of things, because what you have is a very vocal minority who are promoting hatred and intolerance, and sometimes they overshadow the majority that just kind of sits there and listens sometimes. The majority needs to react and take action.
Now, as a professor of sociology, what else would you suggest?
I think that the nation's news media needs to be both careful to screen their material and more active in writing about Islam and its faith and the role that Muslims play in American society. That I think there is a certain kind of fear or media failure to sort of, you know, recognize that there are 6 to 8 million Muslims in America, and these people are functioning at every level in our society, and so that there's a way.
They're not just the Arab Americans, but the rise that was reported on African Americans and stuff.
And the largest segment of the American Muslim population is
African American.
No, actually, Indo-Pakistani. Huh. Indian subcontinent. I mean, not people who just came here, but their descendants, and, you know, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Afghanistan, in that region, consistently shows there's no majority in the Muslim community where one side has more than 50%, but major groupings are African American, Arabic-speaking background, and the subcontinent, South Asian. The American Muslim community is perhaps the most diverse religious community in this country in terms of national origin, ethnicity, age, you know, you name it, we're diverse in it. So it's a very interesting religious community.
So Ibrahim's point then is that the media can help break down the kinds of narrow stereotyping that surrounds Islam. I think that thinking about sort of the role for recreational integration, in which young people are conscious of the faiths of their team members and of those who they are competing with. Thinking again, what are the ways in which we tend to break down stereotypes? There's when we think about the way in which athletics in the United States has been desegregated, and the way in which in locker rooms around America, people sort of have broken down many of the kinds of stereotypes and fears that historically existed.
Part of what the sports and different things like
I
that.
I think an so. Area that you know remains
so
important.
So you think schools, media.
Schools, media, recreation, the churches themselves. And I think that, you know, to get back to our
Wait, the same churches that have been somewhat, I'm a little bit skeptical on how you would approach
that. Categories of churches. You've got the liberal churches who are very welcoming of Muslims and synagogues welcoming. You have also, unfortunately, churches where hatred of Islam is spread.
Right.
We had a recent incident down in Texas. They had a planned Thanksgiving interfaith service, and it was to be hosted at a church. And once the church found out Muslims were coming, they called it off, and the event had to be moved to a local synagogue. And unfortunately, the choir from that church is about to sing at the White House. So we may be asking the president about that. But there's two sides to everything. Nothing is black and white in our society, and you just have to focus on the positive and try and challenge the negative.
So we got just a few seconds left. Would you like to sum that up?
Well, so what my conclusion would be that a report that tells us about the presence of hate crime in America is an important opportunity for us to examine what we're doing to challenge it, and that there is a lot that the American people in all their different civic channels can do to address the problem. And specifically in law enforcement, there is training of both law enforcement and
just
firefighters.
Something we didn't discuss, but that's part of the increase in crime of the hate crimes was actually law enforcement involved with those hate crimes. And that was part of
the report. We don't see that from our perspective. That may be more relevant to other minority communities. Typically, it's not from law enforcement, although we do have a lot of issues in prisons with inmates and that kind of thing. But that's a slightly different category.
Good. Well, I want to thank you gentlemen both for being
Thanks
on the show
having.
And coming to this understanding, and hopefully not only with what you perceived with the additional, the enhancement and some of the things that you have learned also, maybe we have reached some other people.
I'm sure you have.
So, and thank you for joining me here on American Dream. I'm Tina Richards.